So if there's any questions, yes. It's then like practice them in small ways as often as possible. In practicing renunciation, you know, just keep doing it in little ways and noticing what happens. And then see if one can bear with it. Practicing it, say, for a day, giving it up for a day, you know, and then seeing how that works. And then, in giving something up for a day, maybe you enjoy that. And then enjoy that sense of space that gives one. I certainly... You know, my confession time is that I never actually formally took the five precepts because I thought that if I was going to take the five precepts, then I would have to keep them for the rest of my life. I thought it was some sort of promise that I would need to make, that I would never, ever break the five precepts again. I had this sort of idea about what they were. So the first time I formally took the precepts, rather ineptly, was actually the eight precepts. And I thought that I was only going to keep them for, say, 3 months, then I'd need to go back to sex and drugs and rock and roll. That was 30 years ago, you know, 78. I think one can be surprised. One can surprise oneself. Practice in small ways and be interested in how the whole feeling of being a hungry ghost is, and then practice a little bit of generosity out of that sense of, even if it's not within that sphere, but try practicing that, see what happens, see how it works. Good luck, and I think the tea's coming now, but I'll take another question at the back there. You had a question? Okay, did I repeat the question enough? It was what to do about when one feels one experiences the hungry ghost when one practices renunciation. Freedom from greed, freedom from that sense of need, freedom from hatred, freedom from confusion, or freedom from ignorance. And one of the first things one knows is that one knows that one doesn't know. And that's already, it's a great faculty. Knowing that one doesn't know is a great faculty. And then knowing that one knows. These are great powers that humans have. Knowing that they don't know, knowing that one doesn't know, knowing, and then knowing that one knows. Those three things. So I don't know what enlightenment is. I know what enlightenment is, and I know that I know what enlightenment is. Okay. So I know that I don't know what enlightenment is. I get it described to me, freedom from greed, hatred, and confusion. I know that I don't know what freedom from greed, hatred, and confusion is like. Okay? So, in that way, the sort of cycle can work. One knows that one doesn't know what enlightenment is. One gets it described as freedom from greed, hatred, and confusion. Yes? So one knows that one knows it's freedom from greed, hatred, and confusion. And then one knows that one doesn't know what that actually is. Okay? So that then one notices, goes on from there. And then we can deepen it. Does that help? No? What do you wish for? So you want something. It means that he didn't need anything. He didn't want to get rid of anything. And he wasn't confused about anything. 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 He needed nothing. And he didn't want to get rid of anything. Yeah, he was the perfect renunciant. He didn't need anything from the world. He didn't need to get rid of anything from the world. And he was not confused by any experienced. Does that help? Okay. Thank you. Yes? Yeah, maybe after tea. It's good for your soul, a cup of tea. Okay, the tea's being poured. After tea. You're still around after tea.
The man, a man who knows not, knows what he knows not, is a fool, nothing. The man who knows not and knows he knows not is simple, teaching. And a man who knows and knows that he knows not is wise, following.
There you go. Follow him follow him to the T. Okay. Thank you. Afternoon all. Would you like to sit down again and then we can share the questions and have the opportunity to continue the discussion if you wish. There's been one question already about why bother to meditate. So I'm sure you may be interested in.
I was just going to ask, how would you deal with anxiety?
Okay, and the next question is about panic attacks. Anybody panic here? Yeah. Okay, we'll deal with those. Okay. One of the first questions that was asked was about meditation. It was something about the Buddha meditated for 6 years, found he was getting nowhere, and then stopped meditating and then was enlightened. Well, which sounds like fun, doesn't it? Great excuse. There's a story about I'm not sure quite where it is in the scripture, but somebody asked the Lord Buddha, well, why do you meditate? Why do you bother to meditate? Because he used to sit meditation and walk meditation regularly, and the Lord Buddha said, well, it's just what Buddhas do. They meditate. Now, in the morning, he used to walk meditation, the story goes, and with his heart, examine the whole world and see what beings could be enlightened that day, and then make the effort to go there and encourage them to be enlightened. So, and when I talk about meditation now, I talk about not practicing to get enlightened or to get anything out of your meditation, but practice being enlightened. The practice of meditation is the practice of being enlightened. It's not the practice of getting enlightened. And the part of that waking up is to recognize that that which one took to be oneself, the body, the emotions, the movements to and from things, the perceptions, consciousness itself. One doesn't really control. One can't find it as being something that is permanent and satisfactory. Do you find any emotion that you think, well, I'd like to have that emotion forever? And are you able to then sustain it so that it is there forever? Any perception about yourself? How have your ideas about yourself shifted? How have they shifted over time? All the Lord Buddha is pointing to when he's saying there is no permanent self to be found in form, feeling, perception, conception, or consciousness, or in the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, or mind, what he's saying is that one can't find anything in there that will always make one happy, guaranteed, never to move and be permanently happy. Within form, feeling, perception, conception, and consciousness. Within that which is shifting and uncertain, stressful, one cannot find anything that one is really worthwhile saying, this is me, this is I, this is myself. So that's the thing of no soul. Okay? Form, feeling, perception, conception, and consciousness, one cannot find anything that's really going to fully satisfy one. Either in the past or the future, either gross or subtle. One can't find anything that is permanently happy in form, feeling, perception, conception, or consciousness. What is it that's outside of that? Now, if you're going to think about it, then you're going to spin yourself. You're going to spin yourself. It's not going to work. The next question I got was something about anxiety. Anxiety's it's one of the things that can make one anxious is the feeling that one is going to be anxious, so that one then is anxious that one is anxious, and as soon as the anxiety arises, one gets the feeling, well, oh, here it is again, I'm going to be feeling anxious again. And so one develops a sense of almost allergy to it. A tiny bit of anxiety can produce a disproportionate result. And that's true of a few things. That one almost develops like an allergy to it, where a small stimulation can produce a disproportionate result. The tolerance is very low, and so the thing can spin more. To practice a sense of kindness to oneself and a kindness to others, to get in touch viscerally, you know, something that is within one's actual experience, the sense that one does actually wish oneself well. To get in touch with that often is helpful, because then one knows that there is something that one can go to if one finds a way to that. Fluently, easily, with some facility. If that doesn't work sometimes because it's too much, then sometimes all that one can do is bow. We do quite a lot of bowing in this tradition. You know, come in somewhere and you bow, go out from somewhere and you bow, go up to somebody and you bow. Our bowing is pretty Mickey Mouse, really. I quite like the, I think it's the one of the Kagyu traditions, where as a preliminary practice, before you can receive any teaching from the teacher, you have to do preliminary practices. And four preliminary practices, and I often forget three of them. I think it's 100,000 refuges, 100,000 malas, 100,000 something else's, and 100,000 prostrations. And these are prostrations. These are not little dinky bows. These are from standing straight up to flat on your face 100,000 times before you can begin to have any teaching. So before you can come to the Sunday afternoon talks. Have you done your preliminary practices before you can listen to any of the higher teachings? And sometimes I've found when things have been overwhelming, or you know, being caught in some emotion, to have the feeling of, I bow to this. What can be learned from this? This is so strong, or this experience is so strong, that I just need to feel, what can I learn from this? I bow to the Buddha. What is being revealed here? And that sort of sense of surrender, and the wish to learn from it, then of course, can transform it. Yeah? I was talking to somebody about those 100,000 prostrations. And if you do them assiduously, many hours a day, it might take you 3 months to do them. Okay? And they were saying, well, actually what you learn from doing that is that if you can just get one bow right out of the 100,000, that is transforming. Yeah? One sort of sense of, it's nothing I can do. Things happen in their own way. Things reveal themselves in their own way. It's not something that can be forced. Yeah? I don't need to, you know, it's not, I can just surrender and learn from this experience. And have the confidence that what will be revealed will be revealed. Okay, hope that helps the anxiety. Breathing is supposed to be one of the ways of dealing with it in the sort of traditional sort of psychotherapy ways. And certainly if one does have a practice of anapanasati, then one can use that. Anapanasati, mindfulness with breathing, knowing how to... One of the things one can learn with anapanasati is how to change emotions by changing the breath. Changing energetically how one is by changing the rhythm of the breath. One can play with it. So if one's tired, one can play with the breath in different ways. One can learn to play with the breath. Or if one's caught in anxiety, play with the breath. If one's caught in different ways, one can play with the breath. But one has to have some confidence and fluency and familiarity with that in order for that to work. Otherwise, one will spend one whole time being anxious about whether one's getting the breath right. And that can just make it even worse, you know. So. Oh, any further questions? Yes. Kiara.
Thank you.
question about the use of meditation and how it can lead to conceit and self-importance, and an experience that that's seen more in the West than in the East. And a question about, is it my experience and what to do about it within one's own life? Is that right? People's motivation in coming to meditate is sometimes can have an impact on the result they get from it. People's motivation can have an impact on the result they get. Sometimes people come to meditation with the idea that they want to get rid of a lot of things, and they just want to, they don't like themselves, and they just want to get rid of things. Sometimes that can lead to almost a depression and a shutting down in the meditation and in their lives. That can happen. One can spend many hours meditating. And because one just shuts off. Yeah? One can also, I've seen some people meditate and just get very rigid. Very rigid. Sit really still, almost for hours. Some for hours, some 4 hours. It's not confined to just the West, though. It does happen in the East. It's a human thing, but you know, both things are human things. People can misuse their time on their cushion. I usually say, if you want one of the tests of whether your meditation is going well, is, are you growing in humility and gratitude? If you want to test whether your meditation's going well, then if you find that in your life humility and gratitude are growing, then it's going well. If you don't find that humility and gratitude are growing, then you're probably not meditating right. That's what I tend to tell people. It doesn't stop people. Yeah. You know, meditation is a technique, it's a tool. It's like a knife. Like any tool, how you use it, you know, depends on the on your skill and your intention. In one's own life, you know, how to notice it is, our gratitude, particularly gratitude, is helpful. Very helpful for, as an indicator of progress in meditation. And then from that does come humility. It's a sense of one's only able to realize what one has realized because of the gifts of others. Yeah, and then one feels very humbled by that, and then also humbled by the fact of how ignorant one has been. When people come to lead a life in the as bhikkhus or join the monastic community, one of my friends said, what's the most important quality of that, of people who want to, you know, if they want to do that? Of course, Hiriyotapa is important, a sense of self-respect. But with that, the next thing that he says is most important was, and I repeat it, is a sense of humor. You know, if you don't have a sense of humor, then you're taking yourself too seriously. And it's hopeless. You know, it's hopeless. You know, the whole thing is to see through it. And that, you know, the whole thing is ridiculous. This body, this life, these emotions, they're not that, not that important. Yeah. So if you can keep seeing through that and not taking yourself too seriously, being able to laugh at yourself, then you'll probably be able to protect yourself. Yeah, from too much conceit. Yes?
This conceit can go through many things.
Yes.
You know, people who live in Burton look down on people who don't live in
Burton. Yes. Of course. Of course. People who don't live in New York, you know. Look down on the people who live in New York. You know, but luckily for conceit, you know, we are the way that we are. And the last thing that goes is conceit, the conceit I am. And you just notice it, you know. Conceit goes all the way through. All sorts of levels of conceit. People who live in Hemel must be, or Birmingham, or, you know. Yeah, ever so humble. Uriah, he you know, that's why a sense of humor helps. Because it's, you know, you cease to take all of it too seriously. You know, you can laugh at the fact that you feel conceited about coming from Berkhamsted. You know? Or, you know, and it ceases to be so, you know, you see the absurdity of all of it. Yeah? All of the conceit. Everything that you hold as and can get conceited about. It's just that much.
I was with her and somebody said, where do you live? She said, Wandsworth. And the woman said, oh dear.
Oh dear, that she said, oh dear.
I think she was an older woman.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, it was. Yeah. Why is it you can sometimes see the ridiculousness in emotions and that it's still there? It's okay. It's not that one shouldn't have any emotions. You know, that's not that, you know, it's not that one should be insensitive or unaffected by things. It's not like somehow to cut yourself off. Actually, it's being more alive, more sensitive, more tolerant. Yeah? But it's in a much wider context. And that there are these powerful emotions going through cease to be a problem in the old way. Yeah? It's not that they're not there. Yeah? And wanting to get rid of them is like wanting to try to cut something out or cut something off. That's not necessarily very helpful. Yeah? Allow the emotions to go through. They will shift. They will change. Yeah? They don't need to be something that affects one in the same way. Yeah? Because one's stability is resting. One's refuge is outside of that. one's refuge is with the Buddha, seeing them as they are. Yeah. Some people have a lot of faith in the Buddha to encourage them to feel you live with the Buddha. Live with that sense of the Buddha's there. Yeah. And for some people that works. Live with a sense of knowing. Okay. Yeah, so often we feel that, you know, that when we come to the meditation thinking I'm going to get rid of my emotions, that's actually not so safe. Not so safe. And it's a sense of wanting to cut down and cut out. They have their own rhythm. Yes.
You talked about generosity.
Yes.
Do you think that giving dana, you can get rid of your greed permanently, or is it a temporary measure? Unless you get rid of your I or the ignorance, you can't get rid of your greed or anger.
Yeah, it's a practice. It's a practice. Giving at the beginning is giving material things. Yeah? In the beginning it's giving material things. That's very helpful. Giving, you know, the old saying is that if you knew the importance of giving, you would not let a meal go by without giving something. If you knew the importance of giving, this is the Lord Buddha speaking, if you knew the importance of giving, you would not let a meal go by without giving something. It's that important. You probably, at some level, know that. Yes. For people from the UK, it was like, you know, when you're sitting around a table, make sure you pass the butter. Yes. Make sure you share. You find out that the people around you are actually have enough. Yes. Yeah. If you knew the importance of giving, you would not let a meal go by without giving. So don't knock it. It's really, really helpful. And then, okay, you give time, you give energy, yes? And that's a way of feeling that one has enough and learning and developing the other barometers. If you develop any of the barometers fully, then the others come along with them. Yes? So in order to develop generosity, you have to do the rest as well. Yeah? And if you develop all the barometers, then you give them the causes and conditions that will support the Buddha being born in your world. So, you know, and then giving attention. Yeah? And in one's meditation, the gift of attention. So you're not paying attention with the intention of getting something back. Yes, I'm paying attention to my breath, so I will get calm. If I pay enough attention, then I'm going to be repaid by calm. Yes? That's bargaining. Yes? Yeah? And then you're going to sue yourself if you don't get the result. Take yourself to court. Because you've made a contract with yourself, yeah? If I just pay enough attention to my breath, then I will get calm, yeah? No, it's a gift. And a gift doesn't expect anything in return. A gift is a gift. And give clear attention. You practice giving clear attention enough, you'll be fine. You'll be absolutely fine. That's a very, very generous thing. Somebody coming and then feeling that it's, you know, up here everybody's a bit goody-two-shoes, bit too goody-goody. Stick around. It has its dynamics. Yeah, well, the lay group, the great lay group are just here for a little while. You know, they're on their best behavior. We encourage, you know, I say that we generate generosity. We generate morality, and we generate cultivation. Because, you know, yes, people do come here, they're on their best behavior. They do come here with the intention of being generous. The people here who live here are encouraged to be generous. They're encouraged to be, who practice their best behavior. They're encouraged to be wise. There is quite enough dynamic here, if you stick around. Come to the kitchen, you know, and see how, or stick around enough and see how the community dynamic works. It's got enough. This is a very, very human place. It's got the whole range of life here, the whole range. It's not. It is pretty special, and it does do its job, which is, you know, the generation of you know, it does generate generosity, because the whole thing runs on generosity. The whole thing runs on a recognition that, you know, we try to encourage people to see what it's like to be in a place like this, where people are trying to be on their best behavior. But it's not a sure thing. We do get the police up here. We do have difficult people. We do get break-ins. We do have arguments. We don't often resort to fisticuffs. We do get sick. We do the whole thing happens. And then there's all sorts of dynamics that happen. But certainly the lay people, usually when they're here, they're on their best behavior. Or they try to be. But, you know, there are family camps happening at the moment. And it's a little piece of heaven for some of the families, but it's got its own. That'll have its own dynamic as well. You know, it's not just all sweetness and light. But certainly for the period of the meditation, that's what you're trying to put on. It's a bit of a show, really, in some ways. It's like now, you know, it's an encouragement. It's a way of encouraging people to reflect. But actually what you do with it and how this actually works in your life, that'll be up to you. But the short answer is stick around and you'll see. Okay. Yes?
Can I bring up the subject of vengeance?
Vengeance?
Thinking of the Libyan who's
been treated. Yes. Yes.
And the attitude, some people are so angry.
Yes.
Yes.
Vengeance. And where does that live? In the grand scheme of things. I think there's a recognition that there are consequences to actions, and that punishment, state punishment, even so far as execution, was something that was, you know, that was around at the time of the Buddha. It's not something that he said should never happen. Yeah? He recognized that it did happen. And I'm not going to encourage anybody to be an executioner. But it's part of what life is about. You know, pursuing vengeance doesn't help those that are pursuing vengeance. That's the sense of wanting to the sense of wanting to get even doesn't help the people who want to just get even. The sense but recognizing that there are consequences to action is what, so people do get locked up and do get punished. In some ways, if that can lead to rehabilitation, that's fine. And that's the original intention of prisons was rehabilitation, as you probably know. That was the intention. You were supposed to be locked up quietly with a book, and this was supposed to, if you contemplate it long enough, you're going to repent your crimes and come out a better person. This was the idea, the original intention of prisons. Strange, but there you go. They've moved away from that. But in the case of this particular one, I don't have a lot to say because I don't really know what's happening. I can see that there are ways of using situations to make political points. And I think that this is inevitable. That this is going to happen. And this is part of the political process. I really don't know about the rights and wrongs and the ins and outs of this particular one. I think there are obviously people who are able to forgive. Even people who know the person who's killed their child and know that the person has killed their child, there are people who are able to forgive. And there are other people who aren't. I think it's just part of the dynamic. I feel I'm fortunate that I don't have that sort of emotional connection with something like that. The moment I realize that it's quite possible to get worked up about things, that one can feel, I really resent the Romans for invading here. In 66, BC, we must get it, one can work out that sort of thing. But it can go on and on and on forever if one pursues it. But it's part of this, part of human condition. If one can, one can't. This is the way the world is supposed to be. It's not supposed to be a heavenly realm. If it was a heavenly realm, then we wouldn't be so interested in being liberated. That's why somebody was asking about rebirth in heavenly realms, and. In the way Buddhist cosmology goes, that there's many heavenly realms and there's six realms that are below the human realm, and 32 above or something, quite a few, 31 above and six below, or 31 planes of existence, six below the human realms, so 31 minus seven above, And the birth in the heavenly realms, the beings in the heavenly realms, consider a fortunate birth, a birth in the human realm. Because it's got just enough confusion and pain to want to get out, really. And just enough opportunity to do that. Because human beings are great cause creators. Human beings create causes. They're very, very good at creating causes. They're karma makers. And they can create the causes and conditions for enlightenment. And part of it is this sort of mismatch. People say, well, what would happen if everybody was all goody-goody two-shoes? we can at least imagine what it would be like, and that's a helpful thing to imagine. What would happen if everybody decided tomorrow they're going to decide not to kill another human being, at least for a week? You know, that would change the planet. If that was a conscious decision of every human being, that there was going to be no human, deliberate human killing of other human beings for a week, that would change the planet, wouldn't it? Pretty much. You know, let alone, you know, my great one is that I really want everybody to decide not to steal anything, because I hate losing keys. And if I could get everybody not to steal, then I wouldn't have to keep keys. You know, you can start imagining this, but it's not going to happen. And you can go through the rest of it, the rest of the five precepts. And it's at least something you can do as an exercise. But in this case, with this particular person, I think it's just being used as a political thing to stir up emotions one way or t'other. And certainly if people are responsible for, you know, theft or murder or some crime, then the society has some consequences from that. And also it's inevitable that there are going to be some people who suffer consequences that are not correct. Yes, there are going to be people who are incorrectly convicted. Yeah, that is because we make mistakes. We make mistakes. It's inevitable that that's going to happen. Now, if there can be ways of correcting that or ways of dealing with that once it's found out, fine. But, you know, in this country recently, you know, people have been locked up for 30 years or so and then discovered that they weren't actually responsible for what they were locked up for. So the people have got their vengeance, but against the wrong person. Yeah, the DNA and other bits and pieces, but all through history, it's been like that. You know, it's difficult, very difficult. Yes. If the question is, well, if we give up our judgments and opinions, then we're free, and then we don't suffer. Yes and no. Yes and no. When somebody starts to light a fire outside one of the huts here, oh, I give up my judgments and opinions. No, I try to put out the fire and make sure the person doesn't come back. You know, I don't give up my judgments and opinions. When somebody goes around breaking the windows with an axe, thinking that, you know, the monks are living too luxuriously and they shouldn't have windows, no, I call the police and get a restraining order or get them out of here. Sorry. You know, there are consequences to things. And I recognize my limitation, that I have, you know, set responsibilities. That's also making judgments. You know, I think it's also making judgments. Yeah, and when others do something, it has a consequence as well. It's a good reflection. It helps serenity. It helps recognize limitation. It helps recognize limitation. Limitation, as you say, is boundary. You know, it helps recognize boundary, and there are boundaries to things. Yeah. Now, the latest one, the funny one, is in the temple the other night. One of the monks came for locking up. I have to tell you this because it's quite funny. And there was a guy on the mobile phone sitting on Ajahn Sumedho's seat, smoking a joint. No. He just turned up because those gates were open. He said, "No problem. It's organic." The monks have decided to shut the place up a little bit earlier now. I don't recommend that course of action. Yes. Right.
And in the Christian tradition, that would be called grace. That point where you go from anger and hatred to the other side. Is there an equivalent in Buddhism?
Well, that grace is a Christian concept, mm-hmm. and that's one aspect of grace. But that act of forgiveness is certainly in Buddhism. That sense of forgiveness is certainly there. And there are stories of that. The concept of grace is difficult because I'm not really dressed to explain it. You know, I need to have a dog collar. And but there's something about something happening without one's own volition. And something being transformed through that. You know, just in and of itself without one, because there's nothing one can do. And what I encourage people to practice as Buddhists, and particularly, you know, I think it's Ajahn Sumedho or Ajahn Buddhadasa or something, nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to become. Nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to become. If one practices that, then that allows the space for the transformation to take place, particularly helpful when the body is close to death, because if you want to know where you're going, you know, notice what you give attention to, because that's where the rebirth will go. And if you have you're giving attention to the sense of nothing to do, nowhere to go, nothing to become, where will there be rebirth? I hope that helps. Has that shut everybody up? Yes. Find the way to be happy in your work. No. The idea of emptiness is just a tool. It's just an idea. Use it in ways that actually bring happiness rather than despair. You know, it allows you to do fully something without being attached to the result of it. So do your work fully. Fulfill your responsibilities fully. Now find a way to be happy as a husband, as a father, as a in your job, as a friend, and do it fully without expecting a result, and then it's empty of self. Yeah? So you do it fully and completely, so you find joy in it. So there's joy at last to know that there is no happiness in the world. is Ajahn Buddhadasa's phrase. Joy at last to know that there is no happiness in the world. So that one realizes that one's not going to find happiness in all of this, but there's still joy. You know, the joy is that one's not going to look for happiness, and that won't bring happiness. But one still fulfills one's duties fully. I mean, Ajahn Buddhadasa worked tirelessly and found joy, but not in that which mostly people find joy in. It's true. So that's an old it's an old one. But also find a way to love your job. You know, find a way to do your job in ways that you enjoy. You know, if you can't be with the one you love, love the one you're with. That's the old story. It's the old song. Yes. Yeah. Aspiration is helpful. Aspiration, if you want to succeed, you need to aspire to something. And aspiration is not tanha. Tanha is the cause of suffering, and tanha is thirst. Right? Thirst is driven. Aspiration comes from a sense of having enough and being, I can do that. Oh, wonderful. Yeah? You know, I have the capacity to do that. It comes from a sense of already having a sense of fulfillment. Yes? There's a very different feeling to aspiration than to tanha. Yeah? Very, very different, experience. Yeah? And that's actually wholesome. Yeah? I can realize liberation. Wow. No. I can actually find a way to be happy in any situation. Wonderful. Let's see how I can do it. Yeah? And that, I need to be happy in every situation, otherwise I won't be happy. Well, of course you won't be happy. You've wound yourself already into a pit. Last orders. Time, gentlemen, please. Anything more? Thank you.